Man, we said we were on sabbatical, and boy, we are.
Yeah.
Well, it's very nice to be asked along to the party.
Oh, well, we're so pleased you're here.
I'm so glad that when you played truant from school, you said, "Frank, come with us. It'll be great."
That's so true.
Exactly.
It's so true. Yeah.
We'll go to the library.
Yeah.
I've got the gobstoppers. Hello and welcome to our first backlisted special. I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher of Unbound, the platform where readers crowdfund books they really want to read.
And I'm Andy Miller, author of The Year of Reading Dangerously. The format of these specials differs from the main backlisted podcasts, the usual ones that we do, in that they'll feature just one guest choosing a number of books in an area that they know something about, they care something about, and most importantly, they can talk about for an hour. let's see what happens as we welcome to the first backlist special on children's books, Frank Cottrell Boyce.
Hey!
Thanks, Frank Cottrell Boyce. So we're joined by the award-winning novelist and screenwriter Frank Cottrell Boyce, an official friend of Backlisted, who first appeared on episode number 79 to discuss Tove Janssen's Moomin Valley in November, and then teamed up with fellow writer Catherine Rundell for episode 137 on Tristram Shandy, and then again for the now legendary 2021 Christmas show with the weeping in it on the Railway Children.
Our most downloaded show ever. Our most downloaded show ever.
Frank, that's true, Frank. That's true and all.
Yeah, welcome. Welcome back, Frank.
Welcome back.
Okay, so Frank's best-selling children's books include Millions, which won the 2004 Carnegie Medal, Sputnik's Guide to Life on Earth, shortlisted for the Carnegie in 2016, most recently Noah's Gold. All of these books illustrated by Stephen Lenton and published by Macmillan. But there's also, isn't there, I think, Frank, a new book?
The Wonder Brothers, yeah, due in July, yeah.
Exciting. So one of the reasons for doing this show is that Frank made the news before Christmas when he and fellow writer Robin Stevens vented their frustration about the lack of critical conversation around children's books and how this is resulting in a narrowing of choice. The point they were making was simple. If you don't have conversations about children's books, they quickly lose visibility in the culture. So we thought, what better way of helping that conversation happen than by asking Frank about some of the books he loved when he was growing up. So, welcome to the Backlisted Children's Book Special.
Listen, when you made that statement, when you and Robin issued your manifesto, when you nailed it to the door of the cathedral, what were you expecting there to be the surge in response that you got?
Not at all, because honestly, I've been saying the same things for about a decade. It's just a very simple point about choice. And I don't really know why. I mean, I've gone to that cathedral door, nailed it on. Every morning, it's just blown away. For some reason, it stayed up. So, I don't know why it worked this time. I think I had a good aphorism because it was sort of the swirl had started with people talking about celebrity authors and being cross about celebrity authors, which they always are. And my contention is it's not celebrity authors' fault. And actually, some of the celebrities that people are talking about got famous by being good at writing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it said something like, blaming David Walliams because he doesn't write books that you like is like blaming Pizza Express for not selling scatter cushions. Because you know, there is a choice.
Yeah.
Somebody needs to tell you where to buy scatter cushions. And nobody is, you know.
Don't you think that's sort of the case with books in general, though, in the culture? That it is peculiar to me. I mean, I know there's the Sarah Cox show and there's the Graham Norton show, but we're not overburdened really with places where people can discuss books in the broader culture. I suppose there's a lot of recommendation that goes on online. But do you think children's books are particularly disadvantaged?
Oh, I mean, definitely. I mean, I know what you're talking about, but the Booker Prize is still there.
Yeah.
There isn't really a prize for children's books. And if there is, it's very understated anyway. When I won the Carnegie, I honestly thought when I got back to Liverpool there would be an open top tour of the city and the boss took me holding it up. You know, I didn't know that it wasn't a big deal.
It's a hard way to find out, man. It's a hard way.
But I mean, again, in that interview on Today, I said, look, you know, I have a control experiment because I write films.
Yeah.
And the most wretchedly rubbish film that I write is still guaranteed, you know, a quarter of a page review in every broadsheet. I'll still probably be on front row. I might even be on the one show. Someone from the film will be on the one show, will be the writer. And that's a film that I'll open on a Friday and close on a Monday, and hardly anyone will go and see. And if they did, they won't remember it. But like, I could write a towering masterpiece of children's literature, which I do like every year. I'd be very lucky to get, like, I will be jumping around the house if I get a sentence in a roundup, you know. I mean, there are people who review children's books and they're brilliant. Alex O'Connell and, you know, the people flying the flag there, but they're very beleaguered and they're very, very short of space.
And Frank, do you perceive, I know you're going to say yes, but I'm asking this question anyway. Do you perceive that there is a public appetite for it? Or is it I'm playing devil's advocate here. Is it an appetite amongst children's writers who would just like more coverage for their books? I mean, do you feel the public is in need of that conversation, is wanting to have that conversation and doesn't have a forum for it?
I feel children are in need of it. Yeah. You know, because you know how much you gained from the books that you read when you were little. Yeah. And how much power you continue to draw from them, and how True. Much True. They helped build the apparatus of happiness inside you. You know, we should all have found that out the last couple of years, how important it is to know how to be happy. And I gained that from children's books, and I didn't gain them entirely from the children's books that were being, you know, at the forefront of publicity at the time. And actually, I was very well served. You know, we had a children's book club in school where that Scoop thing. We had Kay Webb. We had Jack and Ori.
We had come on to that, won't we? Yeah.
Those things that were kind of books in translation. And now that's narrowed down to virtually nothing, you know. So if David Walliams isn't what you like, there's really not that much else on the show. I mean, I'm absolutely not slagging David Walliams off at all whatsoever. I definitely think there's a place. But there's somewhere that there are other things, you know?
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk about books you liked as children. I've just been writing something about Winnie the Pooh and the House at Pooh Corner, and with which I have quoted from the works of Frank Cottrell Boyce, because he introduced a volume of A.A. Milne's
Happy Half Hours.
Pieces of comic writing. And you wrote the script of Goodbye, Christopher Robin as well.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
But personally, I think Winnie the Pooh is my introduction to comic writing. It's not a children's book per se. It's the earliest introduction I got to the beats of comic writing, which obviously is a huge thing for me in my life. Yeah. And in my heart,
absolutely,
as you say,
you know, it's very difficult to make someone laugh off a page. Yeah. And I guess what Milne does so brilliantly in Winnie the Pooh is that it's so quotable that you go and say those lines and you get a laugh. He gives so generous, you know. Andy gets the laugh for saying that line. You know?
Pathetic, that's what it is. to just choose one. Anyway. So, Frank, what's the first book on your pile that you've chosen for us today?
The first sort of big fat book that I read, which I remember very clearly reading on the bus, which was T.H. White's The Once and Future King. Troubled masterpiece, but extraordinary.
Troubled masterpiece or troubled man? Wasn't T.H. White a troubled man? He was a troubled man, wasn't he?
Well, he was trouble.
Yes, okay.
Sylvia Townsend Warner wrote a biography of him, which is amazing. And it's like a very, very long school report, very disapproving school report. And it's like every page is like, you'll never guess what he's done now.
Yes, okay, yeah. Nikki, have we got a clip from The Once and Future King before we talk about it?
We have got a clip that I took from a BBC radio play from 2014. And this is where Merlin is describing his unique perspective on life. Or the way he sees life, which is slightly back to front.
You know how much information I've got cluttering up my brain? The entire contents of the Encyclopedia Britannica doesn't even come close. It's one of the perils of living backwards, as I'm sure I mentioned when we first met. Or didn't I?
If you did, I'm not sure I understood it then either.
Roll on the Age of Enlightenment. Incidentally, what was I doing when you turned up? Fetching water from the well. Oh, yes. The absence of plumbing. No wonder they'll call this the Dark Ages.
Brian Sibley wrote that script.
Yeah, it's a very, very good adaptation, isn't it?
Brian wrote the Radio 4 adaptation of Lord of the Rings, which is a massive influence on the films. He did The Box of Delights and this is so good. He's so brilliant.
So what's going on there, Frank?
Well, okay. So in the first half of the first book of The Once and Future King is very familiar. And that's how I ended up reading it. It's The Sword in the Stone, which was filmed by Disney. And it's got this brilliant idea in it that Merlin, it's a prequel to Mallory, is what T.H. White called it. And it's the education of King Arthur by Merlin. So Arthur at that time doesn't know he's King Arthur. He sort of lives this sort of feral life in a little castle in the woods. Merlin turns up, but Merlin is living his life backwards so he can remember things from the future. So so it has this brilliant play with anachronism, which makes it incredibly light. But it's got this, there's a sort of magic in that. Because Merlin is in your time, which often in historical novels, people do that, don't they?
Yeah.
Hilary Mantel or whatever, it's like the hero is nice because he's a bit like someone from the 21st century, not like these other tossers from the Middle Ages.
Yes,
and it's always that, isn't it? It's it's Kevin Costner delivering a baby in Robin Hood and all that. It's just like... he does that, but he does it explicitly. And somehow that frees the description of the Middle Ages or this invented Middle Ages. So it feels really, really real. The wild wood, the stuff about falconry, which of course is full of detail, but also the stuff about armor, all this sort of boyish delight in detail is in there. But it floats. It's not clogged. It's like a lot of historical writing is like, like an old antique shop, isn't it? It's full of dust and bits and bobs. Feels really alive because Merlin is T.H. White.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
What's the falconry thing?
Well, T.H. White was trained a gossip. I mean, he was very faddy. He had this great axiom, which is, if you're sad, learn something new. So he was constantly learning to fly, learning to drive.
Right.
But he tried to learn medieval falconry. And if you read... Helen J. MacDonald's H is for Hawk.
Indeed.
She kind of follows his version of the goshawk, and he was a dreadful, dreadful falconer.
Was he?
Oh, he was awful.
But he presents it with confidence, which is
absolutely.
Of
course but then when you read it and you've read her, you think, no, he's telling you he's doing a really terrible job. He just doesn't get that he's doing a terrible job.
He was a teacher, right, at Stowe, and then he kind of dropped out and sort of lived like lived on the land really badly as a sort of semi-feral lifestyle, doing hunting and fishing and badly training his goshawk.
Hunting and fishing, yeah. And then in the Second World War, he disappeared to the west of Ireland and did a lot of goose shooting and, you know, lived off... Well, by then, he could live off his writing because he wrote this monster success, which wasn't good for him, I don't think.
I was going to ask you, was The Once and Future King a bestseller when it was first published?
Or it was colossal,
did it take a little while to warm up?
It was absolutely huge because... obviously Disney bought it, but the Camelot is based on it. It was a sort of big cult among the Kennedy family. It couldn't be bigger. It was huge. I mean, it crops up. If you're reading stuff about the 60s in America, it crops up time and time again. The guys who flew the stealth plane, you know, that big black sub-stratospheric plane, they used to, because it's boring flying those things, they used to read The Once and Future King. It's like... It was everywhere.
Because it's, about five books, really, isn't it? And he wrote it over a period of time.
Yeah, and it's the other books that really grip me. I loved Sword in the Stone.
Because I've only read The Sword in the Stone. I'd be really interested. Because apparently the Lancelot one, The Ill-Made Knight.
I mean, what titles? Queen of Air and Darkness, The Ill-Made Light, The Candle in the Wind.
Yeah. And Lancelot is ugly. This is the key to his portrayal. So he has to be three times as good as everybody else as a knight in order to win Arthur's favour.
But he also is trying to be good. all the time. And of course, falls in love with Guinevere. So he's like literally the worst, the biggest sinner. So he's the serpent in paradise, but he loves paradise more than anybody else does. You know, I must have been like 11 or 12, but even I was gripped by it partly because it's very sexy that, you know, it's not explicit, but it sort of pulses with desire. And I didn't quite know what was happening to me when I was reading it, but it's heartbreaking, that book, absolutely heartbreaking. And there's a scene where Lancelot is asked to perform a miracle because he's so good and the Holy Grail thing is going on and all that stuff. And he knows that he can't because he's like this massive sinner. And he kind of feels that if he doesn't, then he'll give the game away and everyone will sort of sus. It's a really strange situation, but you're completely in it with him. You're thinking, and he does a miracle and everybody's really thrilled, but he's the only one who knows that the miracle is that he was allowed to do a miracle.
I love it.
It's so weird.
and are these books much read now?
I don't know anyone else who's read them.
Yeah, and, right. I've heard of them, of course. I remember selling them when I was a bookseller.
Yeah.
I think I've read The Sword in the Stone, read that when I was a kid, maybe. But I have no sense at all. I'd love to know if you're listening to this and you're a children's bookseller or a bookseller, whether this still does decent numbers through the tills here in 2023. I've no sense of it at all.
You would recommend them though, Frank? You think they're...
I don't know, because like...
You haven't read them for a long time.
Obviously times have changed. No, I do. I dip into them all the time and they're so vivid to me that they're like my personal memories.
Right.
I honestly, they're so vivid that there's some scenes in there that I think I've lived. I know that sounds bad. And they've become part of me. I'm sure there are things to disapprove of them. Like, for instance, the book that I loved most was The Queen of Air and Darkness, which is about the Orkney family. And now if I read it, I can see that part of that is a kind of very English, anti-Irish, racism is the wrong word, but scorn for kind of Irish ideas about honour and bravery and swagger. And it's a bit like Alan Breck in Kidnapped. It's like he's glamorous, but he's also an idiot. And they're like that. And I like now that like my wife's from the west of Ireland, I read them, I think, I know what he's getting at here, but they are lovely. I really do want to be around them, you know, the way they call each other my hearts and my heroes.
Your second choice has also got a wizard in it.
Yeah. I said before, like building the apparatus of happiness. So I've chosen The Wizard of Earthsea.
Yes, by Ursula K. Le Guin.
Yes.
Ursula K. Le Guin.
Whose name comes up regularly in discussions of authors we ought to feature on the main show.
Yeah.
This cameo appearance by Ursula K. Le Guin will not preclude her getting her own full episode of Backlisted in due course, everybody. Don't worry. Now, Ursula Le Guin died, didn't she, 2 or 3 years ago, maybe?
Yeah, it's quite recent. Hopeless at time.
I think of her more as a writer of science fiction than as a children's writer, Frank.
I'm sure that's how she thought of herself as well.
Right. When does this date from in her career, The Wizard of Earthsea?
It's 68. So she'd published other books before. She'd definitely published other sci-fi before.
Yeah, she was big, right? I mean, because it came as a commission, wasn't it?
Yeah, she started with a couple of stories, I think. They started as a couple of stories. That's when she kind of created the Earthsea, what we might now call the Earthsea universe. And then Wizard of Earthsea came in 68. And it sort of became a trilogy. And I think in the end, there were maybe five books in the sequence.
I think I was in year six when I read it. I can remember everything about reading it. I can remember what chair I read it in. I can remember the font, which is a beautiful font. And most of all, the map.
Incredible.
It's got the best map of any book with a map is great. But this is way the best map of any books because it's an archipelago, which I don't think if anybody's done that before, but so the whole of Earthsea is just a massive archipelago and the names are brilliant. And I think I could probably have named all the islands at one point.
How many can you name now? Go.
Oh, go on, let's do that. Gaunt, Kargad, The Hands, Dragon's Run, Pelnor, Uffish. The main one. Where's the school for
Roke?
Roke.
Yay! That was very impressive. I've got a question. Right, we're talking about Frank's favourite children's books, and you've cheated twice now, Frank, because you've basically chosen 10 of your favourite children's books for your first two choices. Why is the fantasy novelist drawn to 5-volume sequences? Why can't they just stop at one?
I kind of wish she had, because I feel dreadful saying this, but like Tombs of Atuan is extraordinary. It's a very short sequel to, or it happens in Earthsea, but the others are a bit, sort of drops off a cliff, really.
Off a cliff. Crikey. Yeah.
She gets a bit kind of taken up with her own sort of a moral kind of.
It becomes very ideological. Yeah. Very. Political.
The Father Shore, I remember being really disappointed by it.
What is the political outlook she's seeking to express then?
I think she thought that they were very male-centric, the books, because they are, she chose to write about wizards, who are traditionally male, and the female characters in The Wizard of Earthsea don't have a lot of agency. Yeah. And one of them in particular is your kind of seductress character. She's only in it for a little bit, but she's, so from a purely feminist point of view, that's unsatisfactory. But her attempt to correct that feels apologetic. It doesn't have the energy and conviction that she had when she just threw herself into that world.
That's interesting.
There's a good female character in Tombs of Atuan, isn't it? It's Tenar.
Oh, absolutely amazing. And she should have given herself more credit for having done that, I think. Yeah. Tombs of Atuan's extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary book.
It's interesting, but there's a lot of stuff in there. I mean, people have said that unlike most of the wizards that are kind of derived from Malory, the Merlin is a sort of middle-aged academic, which you could say in a way T.H. White does and Garner does with Cadellan and obviously Gandalf in Lord of the Rings. The original thing about Earthsea was to have a young wizard being trained.
We've got a clip of her explaining about how she came up with that idea. Oh, right. Do you want to have a listen?
Yeah, brilliant.
Yes, please.
I'd been asked to write a fantasy for teenagers. And I thought, I haven't written anything for kids. So I sort of said, I don't know how to write for children. It's a different art. And he said, well, think about it. So I went home and I did think about it. And because the book was to be for young people, I guess is what put it in my head, that all the wizards in all the books that I had read in 1967 were old. They were old men, old white men with white beards and white hair and peaky caps, But you can't be an old man without having been young. And it occurred to me, how does a wizard, how does he start out? And, obviously he's got a lot to learn. So where do you learn things? You learn them in school. So you go to wizard school? Ooh. Okay, now I'm telling you, this is 1967. there have been other wizard schools,
It's not just that he's young yet. He's from nowhere.
Yeah.
He's poor. His mum is a single parent. They live the back of beyond. No wizards come that way. And he goes to this posh school, and all that thing of like going to a big venerable institution, feeling you don't really belong there. And because you don't really belong there, trying a bit too hard. And in this case, creating an absolute disaster by doing that. But being sure that he's great as well. That social mobility side of it, and also the sexiness of knowledge. That book really made knowing things cool. And in particular, there's like two different ways to know things. There's illusion, which is impressive and fancy and talkative and a bit Boris Johnson-y. And there's also another teacher called Origen, who who walks around and really gets to understand a particular flower so that he really understands that flower before moving on to the next flower or the next stream or the next pebble, and gets to know a bit, you know, you just said Gavin Garner, a bit like Alan Garner, who lives in this tiny patch of land but knows it to the earth's core.
And it's the naming, isn't it? It's the power of real, the real names. I just remember, still remember that bit when Ged gets his name Ged, doesn't it? It's amazing.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
So we would have read these books, 60s and 70s. Frank, you were saying the themes you're describing there in the Earthsea books, they are very 60s, that kind of young upstarts. That's one of the great 60s themes of film and literature and theatre in the 1960s, as we know.
Yeah.
And the young upstarts would have included Puffin to some extent, wouldn't they? You know, the Puffin, the books of our... We're all old and old now, and we remember the Puffin Club from the 60s and 70s and how important Kay Webb was running Puffin, and the way in which she and the people she worked with pushed books which were often challenging is the right word. But they knew were good.
Absolutely. And books in translation, a lot of books in translation. Yeah. Which that doesn't seem to happen very much anymore at all.
I suppose including, the Moomin books,
The Moomins, Agaton Sachs, I've just reread. Swedish detective book, you know, mad things.
Eric
and
Kastner.
It made you feel like the world, Eric Kastner, of course. But you felt like the world belonged to you, you know?
Yeah. And it was also that genius of the club idea, wasn't it? And Puffin Post, and that sense of being part of something with other kids. Which
obviously I didn't go on those. You could go on a Puffin holiday.
Yeah, I know. Puffin trips, never afford it.
No, I'm a world away. But I read that Kay Webb biography, and she wasn't. She was brilliant, a brilliant editor. She wasn't great on health and safety, I don't think.
I
obviously thought the Puffin Club had members to spare.
Your next book was also another classic Puffin author.
Well, I've chosen an anthology of Joan Aiken's stories, and my copy is called A Small Pinch of Weather.
Yeah.
But I think those stories were always being shuffled around. Joan Aiken produced. She's like a kid's Michael Moorcock or something. You know?
Over 100 books.
but all in different kind of franchises.
Yeah.
You know, so there's like these books about, there's books set in the wolf world. Where,
yeah, Wolves of Willoughby Chase. And
Where James III is King of England or whatever. And there's Mortimer and the Mortimer the Raven, this raven that goes around going Nevermore, which was sort of very... very overtly funny, and they were written for Jack and Ori. But what I loved, and honestly, it was like, I remember reading them thinking, are you allowed to do this? Were the Armitage stories, which are stories about a very, very middle-class family, like, but for some reason that didn't bother me. They live in a magic world, but like the magic is so taken for granted in these stories. That it's just sort of an annoyance, isn't it?
Yeah.
They've got like an uncle who comes to stay, who's sort of badgered somebody and bought the apple of discord off somebody.
Yeah.
And he's very bumptious, and he's a colonel, and he doesn't notice things. So he doesn't notice that the Furies, the Ironies, are camped on the doorstep because they want the apple of discord back. But the rest of it is like, it's as though that happened in a William Brown story.
Mm.
You know, there's a sort of grumpily... preoccupied father, kind of quite caring but sort of slightly distant mother, and kids dealing with all these, you know, elemental forces. But there's none of that kind of like, oh, the adults wouldn't believe us type of thing. It's like they would, but they would just be busy. Oh, the Furies are on the doorstep. Well, you know, can you see to that, darling?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
The great uncle Gavin is a brilliant character because he's just incredibly sort of. He's just grumpy all the way through. And
he can see them, can't he? See the Furies. They're on the doorstep. The Furies are on the doorstep, pointing, the kindly ones, pointing accusingly at him. And he just sort of breezes past them all the time.
My wife always says that she, when she was, she's a voracious reader as a child. She grew up in a working class household, and she says, it never bothered me. Class was not a thing that bothered me when I was a child reader. It never bothered me. Amongst her favourite books were The Bagthorpe Saga by Helen Cresswell. She said, and I didn't read those thinking, "Guru, I resent these Bagthorpes with their nice house and their ramshackle existence." She was just, I thought how lovely it must be to live like that. She says she used to watch the Good Life on TV and think, well, that's the house I want to live in. Margot and Jerry's house, by the way, not Tom and Barbara's. Margot and Jerry's lovely house.
Yeah, the world divides. It depends, though, doesn't
it? Because so, like, some of those, like, well, I said The Armistice didn't bother me, but I hated Matilda. I couldn't bear to look at Matilda because I knew that the finger was being pointed, the baddies and the ridiculous people were my people, you know? So it depends.
What do you mean, like, by Matilda by Roald Dahl?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's hideous, it's you know, class hatred. How are you? It's awful.
Yeah, and the twits.
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more, Frank.
Have you got a bit to read from the Armitages? Well, I've got a little bit here about Great Article Gavin, which is quite funny.
What do you? Oh, you read it, John. We love to hear it in your voice.
Okay. So this is Mark. There's Mark and Harriet, the kids, right? And Mark is being told off by his great uncle Gavin. Here we go. Bless my soul, boy. Nearly all great-uncle Gavin's remarks began with this request. Bless my soul, what are you doing now? Reading? Bless my soul. Do you want to grow up a muff? A muff, great-uncle? What is a muff exactly? And Mark pulled out the notebook in which he was keeping a glossary of great-uncle Gavin. A muff? Why, a muff is a funk, sir. A duffer, a frouse, a tug, a swat, a miserable little sneaking milksop. Mark was so busy writing down all the words that he forgot to be annoyed. You ought to be out of doors, sir. Ought to be out playing footer. But you need 22 people for that, Mark pointed out. And there's only Harriet and me. Besides, it's summer, and Harriet's a bit of a duffer at French cricket. Don't be impudent, boy. Gad, when I was urgent, I'd been out collecting birds' eggs. Birds' eggs, said Mark, scandalised. But I'm a subscribing member of the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. Butterflies, then, growled his great uncle.
It's brilliant.
It's really good.
So Joan Aitken she had a long and glorious career, did she? I love the description of her as the Michael Moorcock.
Yeah, she was 2004. 2004 she died. And
she's got that kind of Moorcockian volcanicness as well. So if you do sit down and read all the endless sequels to The Wolves of Willoughby Chase, they're full of contradictions and discontinuities because she was just like, get it down. It's okay, like there's nothing. Yeah. There's nothing considered about them. They're just full of this
energy
of like, wouldn't it be great if there was a huge pink whale? Or we had a gun that could shoot us to America? Or, you know, it's like, let's do it.
Bizarrely, she wrote a whole sequence, I think six or seven, Jane Austen
sequels.
Sequels, you know, Mansfield Revisited and the Young Miss Ward and...
Yeah.
And were those written for children? Were they for children or were they... books for adults?
I think they were for Jane to show how she could do it.
Yeah.
If she put her mind to it. But I want to say there's one story. I mean, all the Armitage stories are fun and I really like them. And some of them have really stuck with me. Smoke from Cromwell's Time, Harriet's Heirloom, where she inherits it doesn't matter. But there's one, The Cereal Garden,
which
is one of the most painfully romantic and beautiful story that you've ever read. And it starts with cutting out of, you know, do you remember on the back of cereal packets? There used to be models that you would cut out and bend flap A, glue to flap C. He's building one of these and it's from an engraving of, and they're on breakfast bricks, which is a rubbish cereal. And he builds this garden and it's from a set of 18th century engravings. And it turns out that someone has been hidden in this garden magically inside the engraving. For love, and
he's waiting for the lover to come.
Yeah, and you do know who the lover is, and it's who's now an old man, and it's so beautiful, it's so perfectly plotted, it's like a little piece of Mozart, isn't it? It's just
and
it's a heartbreaking story, amazing.
Everybody should read it, but I can't tell you the ending. But I know that Joan Aitken herself was so mortified. She had so much correspondence from people saying, how could you have how could you have done this to these beautiful characters? She took it out of her collection of stories because she was so, she felt that she...
Really?
Yeah, she's... And it is it's certainly of all the Armitage ones, which I thank you for recommending, because I read them this week, and what joy. I mean, amazing. But that's just one of the great, saddest stories ever told.
It's absolutely heart-wrecking story.
We're talking to Frank about his favourite children's books, and we've talked about fiction so far, but maybe we should talk about non-fiction. And John, my dear co-host John, has written the following words on my notes. Discussion of I Spy.
Oh, right.
Now, I Spy book. Now, I Spy books. Who wants to start on these beautiful things? I Spy books. Frank, did you have a set of I Spy books as a child?
I've still got them.
Oh!
I've still got mine as well. Not here, Frank, but it's like it is. But don't you think if you were a curious child in the late 60s, early 70s, they were absolutely the most brilliant thing. I mean, I've talked about them on Locklisted and my father was absolutely mortified because it was the Daily Mail where Big Chief I Spy would communicate with his chief.
Couldn't be more problematic.
Yeah, and so we weren't allowed to have the Daily Mail in the house.
You know, as far as cultural appropriation goes.
I remember, didn't Big Chief I Spy have his wigwam, presumably?
Wigwam by the water.
Yeah, wasn't it Shepherd's Bush Green?
That something like that, yeah.
I can remember being on a birthday outing in the 70s, driving through Shepherd's Bush Green, and this is true, looking desperately round for Big Chief I Spy's wigwam and seeing nothing.
You used to get a little badge, an I Spy badge, which you'd... And you'd see other people who had I Spy badges. And it was a bit like, you know, people with VWs waving. It's like, amazing, there's another, you know, what are you? And mine were always on archaeology and the countryside.
John, do you know anything about the wizard publisher who came up with that idea? Do we know anything about how lucrative they were?
I think it was very lucrative.
The plan for it.
Big Chief I Spy was Charles Worrer, a former headmaster who created I Spy towards the end of his working life. He retired in 56, but lived until 95 when he died at the age of 106.
Wow, did he?
Yeah.
And he presumably absolutely loaded.
Yeah. David Bellamy became Big Chief I Spy at one point in the 80s, yeah.
Gosh. Well, they're about noticing things.
They were about noticing things.
Beginning of happiness is noticing things, isn't it? So they were telling you to keep looking. And there were things that are problematic. I mean, everything was hierarchical, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So. We moved, like, this is terrible, but I had I Spy birds, right?
And
I live with my gran right next to Dr. Nipper. We never saw any, but we saw seagulls. That was it. And then we moved. And they weren't, there's no seagulls in there. And so when we moved to this housing estate on the edge of Liverpool, which had fields behind it. And I was like, this is going to be ace. So I just sat in the window with this I Spy book. And honestly, because of course, what had happened to clear the estate, there was like every tree for miles around had gone. There was like nothing for a bird to eat or roost on. And I sat there with this book and like literally never saw a bird for months. Then we went to Wales for the day and I saw dippers. I thought, yes, banzai, dippers. And there's hundreds of them. Just like, I got home, dippers are not in the book. What? And everything was hierarchical.
Like there's something Beckettian about that you just endlessly waiting for the bird that never comes. The bird does come, it's not in the book.
Those books dominated my childhood in a way. You know, family trips out were all about, I need to collect some more things for my eyes.
Okay, so I'll tell you this little, well, two things. One is that in that spring after we moved in, the whole estate was just absolutely invaded by house martins because there was so much mud. And it was like a two-species living space. And five bloody points you got for a house martin, for Christ's sake. It's like, I knew I was seeing this like massive wildlife spectacle, but we got 5 points for it.
Same thing happened to me with waxwings. There was a massive invasion of waxwings in Felling in the northeast when I was a kid. And waxwings weren't in the book, but I wrote them. There's a bit where you could say an interesting bird that you have seen.
So the reason I've still got my copies is that I've been decanting my mum and dad's house. They died last year, and I found I Spy in the countryside, and he's just full of lies, you know. So it filled it in full of, you did not, as if you did. But this is so, right, so we went to the same place, this is getting very autobiographical now, but we went to the same place on holiday every year. We saw the Dippers, a tiny village just outside Llangollen in North Wales. Every year, no exceptions, that's the only place we ever went. And so I scattered my mum and dad's ashes there. Then I found these I Spy books in our house. And on the last page of I Spy in the Countryside, it says, what's your favourite view? My dad had filled it in with a tempo pen, and he described where we went on our holidays, where I'd scattered his ashes.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Amazing. Yeah. I must have been about six or seven when he'd done that.
But I Spy wasn't actually the book you'd chosen. The book you'd chosen was another Noticing Things book, wasn't it?
So I don't know this book at all. This is a book called The Rudiments of Wisdom by Tim Hunkin.
That is QI. That is, you want to know where QI comes from? It comes from that.
Oh, really?
Really, yeah, it does.
So, Frank, tell us about the book. What is The Rudiments of Wisdom?
Right, so The Rudiments of Wisdom was originally a cartoon strip in The Observer magazine in which he would tell you something about something. These great drawings. I love the drawings because they were so imitable. Yeah. And the people looked a bit like kind of, they had a look of the Easter Island statues. And he would use them to illustrate how the Mechanical Turk worked or how a tower bridge worked or something like that. It would be a diagram about how machines worked. But also he would give you these fantastic kind of experiments that were kind of bordering on magic tricks.
Yeah.
You know, how to make how to make your own toothpaste, how to make steel floats,
yeah.
how to use two umbrellas to amplify sound. How to make an ink volcano. These are all stuck in my head, you know. How to walk through a postcard, how to pull a piece of string through your neck, how to chop a banana in half before you peel it, all these like, and they were just like, it was that kind of on the cusp between mechanics and magic, you know, and that's an Ursula Le Guin phrase, isn't it? Isn't there? It's Asimov, isn't it? At some point, every technology might as well be magic.
Yeah.
And so, this is how your TV works, and this is how to vanish. It's like the same.
And then he made The Rudiments of Wisdom into a book, into an encyclopedia, in the late 80s, which I think it's still available. It's just a joyous kind of rag bag of stuff. He invented The Secret Life of Machines, the TV show.
That's
The Secret Life of Machines.
Yeah. And I was worried that I was cheating choosing it as a book because it was a book in my house because I cut it out every week and stuck it in a scrapbook.
Yeah.
But then it did come out as a book, didn't it?
But he would have loved that. He's kind of, you know, he's in that great tradition, Andy, of sort of mad English inventors.
I was going to say children's books with cross sections and diagrams.
Yeah.
They're a lovely thing.
100%.
Yeah.
And especially this, because fundamentally unserious and therefore it stuck. There was like an element of like, as John just said, it's Wilfred Makepeace Lunn is the other one.
Yeah, Wilf Lunn, that's right.
It was also my great hero, the jazz composer Neil Ardley, who had a second life in the 1980s as one of the authors of How Things Work.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He'd been living on Arts Council grants and brown rice for 15 years. And then he becomes a million-selling children's book author in the space of a year. It's the most incredible. There's a biography coming out of Ardley, which I'm really looking forward to reading. It's very, very interesting. It makes me think of the recently reissued Usborne Ghosts books and... Or the Usborne to Being a Spy. Do you remember that one? It's that mixture of, as you say, Frank, kind of diagrams and practical suggestions of how to do amazing things.
Yeah.
That you, the child, can, if you just do follow this instruction,
you can
astonish
it.
The world.
Yeah.
And he does the most, you might have seen the water clock at Covent Garden in Neil's yard, Andy, outside. That's a Tim Hunkin invention. But he was, what I love is there's a great, I found this great little quote from him. He said, a few years ago, while I was doing a short fellowship at Xerox Park, the director asked me if I was attached to an institution or if I was a floater. He said it implying that being a floater was a good thing. I was amazed, as in Britain, people like this are regarded as mad eccentrics and the word floater means a turd that won't sink. Definitely. He also, he designed, you love this, rock trivia, he designed the Flying Pigs and Sheep for Pink Floyd's In the Flesh tour, their Animals tour.
Yeah,
did he? Do you know what? Yeah. I was just thinking, he sounds really like, you owned Wilf Lund, he sounds like Bruce Lacey. He sounds like Bruce Lacey, this famous 60s and 70s inventor who kind of has one foot in the goons camp and another foot in the rock and roll camp. You must have met him. Have you met him?
No, I mean, I would love to meet him because he is, he's just, I think like Frank, he was in the back of the Observer magazine. And that was, for me, that was, I used to do the same thing. I used to cut out all the rudiments of wisdom clippings. And I often wondered what happened to him. And then I discovered he'd sort of re-emerged on television. And
the magazine had a children's section.
Yeah.
Can you believe it?
Amazing.
You're back on your warpath, if you don't mind me saying, Frank. We should go on to the fifth of Frank's choices.
The final choice.
Final children's book that you've chosen. What, Frank, have you chosen for us?
Just William, because they're breathtaking. But I owe a particular debt to Just William. Shall I tell you what that is?
Please do.
When my dad was very little, my dad is much the youngest of his brothers, and his brothers were all at sea when he was a little boy. And his brother Jim, my uncle Jim, came back from sea. I can picture this, even though obviously I wasn't born, but he came back with his backpack, you know, his kit bag, swung it down and took a present out of the bag and gave it to my dad. And it was Just William. And it was the first book that my dad had owned. And my gran, my mum was very suspicious of it. She said, "What is that?" And Uncle Jim said, he said, "It's about a young boy who commits depredations." That's what me. Which he's obviously winding his mum up. And it's how Just William is that word, depredations. It's a very Just William word. Anyway, my dad read it, loved it. And my dad, you know, became a big reader, went to night school. And when I was young, my dad did open university and became a teacher. And that kind of thread of autodidacticism and writing comes from Just William, comes from that gift of a book at the right age to the right book, the right age to the right boy.
Yeah.
And everything, you know, that I've had this enchanted life goes back to that gift from Uncle Jim and goes back actually to Richville Crompton's amazing ability to turn a funny sentence.
What is it about Richville Crompton's prose, I want to say? What does she capture that other writers struggle to capture?
Well, and that you can't dramatise either. No, you can't make Just William funny on screen. It's the style. It's like she's the first writer that you read where you think the way she writes her sentences is amazing. You know, that's she's the first writer whose style you notice.
Okay.
And what is it about? Like just the inappropriateness of talking about a little boy who just wants to be left alone with a bag of bullseyes and a mongrel dog. As though it was, you know, the United Nations, this amazing vocabulary that she brings to bear on it all, you know, and he's preoccupied, you know, and that William stands for something, you know, he stands for the great virtue of just being left alone, just because all he wants is to be left. And I think the other thing about Just William that people forget is that Just William is always trying to be good. You know, that's the difference between him and other badly behaved children. He is burning for justice. He always wants to put things right, and he's always just trying to be good. It just goes hideously wrong.
So I've got a question. Is she, and again, this year, I'll just ask the question straight from a writerly point of view. When you read her now, Frank, does she seem totally in control of the material? You know, because you're talking, when you say it's hard to dramatise, I know exactly what you mean. It doesn't seem particularly distinguished. And therefore, what distinguishes it is the style. Now, has she chanced upon it, or is she a Woodhousian stylist who can make it sing?
Yeah, I think she can make it sing. I think she knows how to create a really great phrase.
Yeah,
and it's particularly a great speech, a great rant. But the stories that work are the stories that work up to a great big set piece. So where William is told a lie, that just as you're reading it, that lie is growing and getting more and more out of control, and it's happening on the page. It's at its best when it's just him talking and you're thinking, just shut up, you know.
Yeah.
And he's just making everything worse. So she's brilliant. I mean, what I read her for is like how she engineers those. It's usually a lie that's grown, It's Frank. It's the ones that are reliable that really work.
And she's one of those Crompton is one of those writers, and she was her dad was a vicar. She was a teacher. She never married. She never had kids. But she became quite wealthy. It's a rather sweet story. She bought a house that she and her mother lived in on Bromley Common because they were incredibly successful from day one. It was another one. She hit on some formula that was perfect at the time, and wrote what I hadn't realised. The first one was written in 1922, alongside Ulysses and The Wasteland. And the last one was written in William the Lawless was written in 1970.
Yeah.
Which is
wow. I mean, so it's nearly 48-year career. Wow.
He never aged a day in all that time.
No, he never grew up.
He never grew up. But that's like P.G. Woodhouse, isn't it? I always think P.G. Woodhouse, those first ones are satirizing suffragettes. Yeah. And at the end of his life he was working on something with Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Yeah, it is mad, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, I've got one more note here before we go, and I can't let this pass.
No.
Frank to mount his Narnia defence.
Before the bun run.
Oh, really? Okay, well, I just, people are constantly slagging off Narnia because it's proselytising, and also because it's inconsistent. Yeah. And I want to defend it, that Father Christmas is in it, and nymphs and satyrs and, talking animals and where is that supposed to be? And where that is that room in the house that he grew up in, full of children's books. And it's a great kind of synthesis. And people are always saying, it's indecorous the way it smashes up all these things together. And I think that's the most powerful thing about it, is that where it's set is where stories are set, and it brings all those different stories together. And it's that room full of books in his house, that is the wood between the worlds. And he's allowed to do that. I think that's all. I think of all the worlds that that you've read, Narnia is the one you want to visit.
It's a multiverse, Frank.
Yeah. Well, it is, isn't it? Because they go to Sean.
I also think, The Magician's Nephew is a seriously underrated
book. It's an amazing book.
And I think I'm really interested because I think he does cop a lot of unfair kind of criticism, and they don't like the fact that he apparently punishes Susan in the last battle, and there's sort of borderline racism in some of the or straightforward.
If we did one of these novels, if we did one of C.S. Lewis's novels as a novel on Backlisted, and because it's Backlisted we wouldn't be allowed to do The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, so which novel do we do?
I would do The Magician's Nephew.
Yeah.
Because it had that power that you get when you're addicted to a comic as well, and then you suddenly find the origin story comic.
Yeah.
After you've read 10 Spider-Man adventures, you suddenly find, and it had that origin story power, which is for me.
And I had one question. I know that you'd listened to our Christmas episode on Noel Streetfield, but The Giant Under the Snow was a book, your Giant Under the Snow story.
Well, I was right. Okay, so by the time I got to secondary school, I was a very school-shaped boy in a way that was probably quite obnoxious. I went to the same school that Johnny Vegas went to and that Una McCormack went to. And I finished my math exam very quickly, and I just slipped the copy of Giant Under the Snow out from under my blazer and just started reading it because I was bored. And my teacher came round. He wasn't my math teacher, but I had a nice math teacher. The teacher who was invigilating came around and said, "What the hell do you think you're doing?" I said, "Well, I've finished, sir. Do you want to take it?" And he just took Giant Under the Snow off me and he hit me across the face with it. And then he took it away, right? And I never, it was a scoop, Puffin Club copy. So it wasn't in the library. Never saw it again. He never gave it me back. And then I found a copy in Wigtown when I was a grown-up, and a dad. Yeah. And thought, "Oh, there's that book." And I took it. And honestly, I didn't need to start again. I remembered everything about where I was. As soon as I opened the book, the font again, I opened it, found where I was up to and carried on reading from there. And I didn't need to, because it had stayed with me so much, Brilliant book.
Well, listen, thank you so much for spending an hour with us.
It was wonderful.
Talking through some of these books. It's really fantastic.
Thank you.
And listeners, We'll put all these up on the website with links to...
We will, and we put them in the backlisted bookshop on bookshop.org as well. So thank you, Frank. Thank you to Nikki, who's breaking into her sabbatical to pull this special episode together.
Thanks, Nick. We'll be back in April, but in the meantime, there's nothing to stop you downloading all 176 previous episodes. What? Plus, follow links, clips and suggestions for further reading by visiting our website, backlisted.fm. We're always pleased if you contact us on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram.
And you can support us directly by supporting our Patreon at www.patreon.com/backlisted for a modest sum. Patrons get to hear backlisted episodes early and ad-free. And all those who subscribe to the Lot Listener level get two extra podcasts a month called Lot Listed, which features the three of us talking over the books, films and music we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight.
And we're still making those throughout our sabbatical. Once again, our sabbatical is a failed sabbatical. But we're trying. That's all, folks. Frank, is there anything you would like to add? You can have a bonus choice if you want.
Oh.
You can have a bonus choice. One more book. Go on. Have one more book.
Actually, King of the Copper Mountain, Paul Bagel. Absolutely amazing book.
Okay.
There you go. We'll put that up on the website as well. Thanks very much, everyone. And we'll see you next month for another Backlisted special.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.